The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. The Yoga of Integral Knowledge, Chapter 24, Gnosis and Ananda, page 506. The soul lives. It is not abolished. It is not lost in a featureless indefinite. For on every plane of our existence, the same principle holds. The soul may fall asleep in a trance of self-absorption, dwell in an ineffable intensity of God-possession, live in the highest glory of its own plane. The Ananda Loka, Brahma Loka, Vaikuntha, Goloka of various Indian systems. Even turn upon the lower worlds to fill them with its own light and power and beatitude. In the eternal worlds, and more in all worlds above mind, these states exist in each other. For they are not separate, they are coexistent. Even coincident powers of the consciousness of the Absolute. The divine, on the Ananda plane, is not incapable of a world play or self-debarred from any expression of its glories. On the contrary, as the Upanishad insists, the Ananda is the true creative principle. For all takes birth from this divine bliss. Therefore, the world of the Ananda is called the Jnanaloka, in the double sense of birth and delight. All is pre-existent in it, as an absolute truth of existence, which the Vijnana brings out and subjects to voluntary limitation by the idea and the law of the idea. In the Ananda, all law ceases, and there is an absolute freedom without binding term or limit. It is superior to all principles, and in one and the same motion, the enjoyer of all principles. It is free from all gunas and the enjoyer of its own infinite gunas. It is above all forms, and the builder and enjoyer of all its self-forms and figures. This unimaginable completeness is what the Spirit is. The Spirit transcendent and universal. And to be one in bliss with the transcendent and universal Spirit is for the soul, too, to be that and nothing less. Necessarily, since there is on this plane the absolute and the play of absolutes, it is ineffable by any of the conceptions of our mind or by signs of the phenomenal or ideal realities of which mind conceptions are the figures in our intelligence. These realities are themselves indeed only relative symbols of those ineffable absolutes. The symbol, the expressive reality, may give an idea, a perception, sense, vision, contact, even of the thing itself to us. But at last we get beyond it, to the thing it symbolizes. Transcend idea, vision, contact, pierce through the ideal, and pass to the real realities, the identical, the supreme, the timeless and eternal, the infinitely infinite. Our first absorbing impulse, when we become inwardly aware of something entirely beyond what we now are and know, and are powerfully attracted to it, is to get away from the present actuality and dwell in that higher reality altogether. The extreme form of this attraction, when we are drawn to the supreme existence and the infinite Ananda, is the condemnation of the lower and the finite as an illusion and an aspiration to nirvana in the beyond. The passion for dissolution, immersion, extinction in the spirit. But the real dissolution, the true nirvana, is the release of all that is bindingly characteristic of the lower into the larger being of the higher. The conscious possession of the living symbol by the living real. We discover in the end that not only is that higher reality the cause of all the rest, not only it embraces and exists in all the rest, but as more and more we possess it, all this rest is transformed in our soul experience into a superior value and becomes the means of a richer expression of the real. A more many-sided communion with the infinite, a larger ascent to the supreme. Finally, we get close to the absolute and its supreme values, which are the absolutes of all things. We lose the passion for release. Mumukshutva, which till then actuated us, because we are now intimately near to that which is ever free, that which is neither attracted into attachment by what binds us now, nor afraid of what to us seems to be bondage. It is only by the loss of the bound soul's exclusive passion for its freedom that there can come an absolute liberation of our nature. The divine attracts the soul of man to him by various lures. All of them are born of its own relative and imperfect conceptions of bliss. All are its ways of seeking for the Ananda. But, if clung to till the end, miss the inexpressible truth of those surprising felicities. First in order comes the lure of an earthly reward, a prize of material, intellectual, ethical, or other joy in the terrestrial mind and body. A second, remoter, greater version of the same fruitful error is the hope of a heavenly bliss far exceeding these earthly rewards. The conception of heaven rises in altitude and purity till it reaches the pure idea of the eternal presence of God, or an unending union with the eternal. And last, we get the subtlest of all lures, an escape from these worldly or heavenly joys and from all pains and sorrows, effort and trouble, and from all phenomenal things, a nirvana, a self-dissolution in the absolute, an ananda of cessation and ineffable peace. In the end, all these toys of the mind have to be transcended. The fear of birth and the desire of escape from birth must entirely fall away from us. For, to repeat the ancient language, the soul that has realized oneness has no sorrow or shrinking. The spirit that has entered into the bliss of the spirit has naught to fear from anyone or anything whatsoever. Fear, desire, and sorrow are diseases of the mind, born of its sense of division and limitation. They cease with the falsehood that begot them. the Ananda is free from these maladies. It is not the monopoly of the ascetic. It is not born from the disgust of existence. The bliss soul is not bound to birth or to non-birth. It is not driven by desire of the knowledge or harassed by fear of the ignorance. The supreme bliss soul has already the knowledge and transcends all need of knowledge. Not limited in consciousness by the form and the act, it can play with the manifestation without being imbued with the ignorance. Already it is taking its part above in the mystery of an internal manifestation, and here, when the time comes, it will descend into birth without being the slave of ignorance, chained to the revolutions of the wheel of nature. For it knows that the purpose and law of the birth series is for the soul in the body to rise from plane to plane and substitute always the rule of the higher for the rule of the lower play, even down to the material field. The bliss soul neither disdains to help that ascent from above, nor fears to descend down the stairs of God into the material birth, and there contribute the power of its own bliss nature to the upward pull of the divine forces. The time for that marvelous hour of the evolving time spirit is not yet come. Man, generally, cannot yet ascend to the bliss nature. He has first to secure himself on the higher mental altitudes, to ascend from them to the gnosis. Still less can he bring down all the bliss power into this terrestrial nature. He must first cease to be mental man and become superhuman. All he can do now is to receive something of its power into his soul in greater or less degree by a diminishing transmission through an inferior consciousness. But even that gives him the sense of an ecstasy and an unsurpassable beatitude. And what will be the bliss nature when it manifests in a new supramental race? The fully evolved soul will be one with all beings in the status and dynamic effects of experience of a bliss consciousness intense and illimitable. And since love is the effective power and soul symbol of bliss oneness, he will approach and enter into this oneness by the gate of universal love, a sublimation of human love at first, a divine love afterwards, at its summits a thing of beauty, sweetness, and splendor, now to us inconceivable. He will be one in bliss consciousness with all the world play and its powers and happenings, and there will be banished forever the sorrow and fear, the hunger and pain of our poor and darkened mental and vital and physical existence. He will get that power of the bliss freedom in which all these conflicting principles of our being shall be unified in their absolute values. All evil shall perforce change itself into good. The universal beauty of the all-beautiful will take possession of its fallen kingdoms. Every darkness will be converted into a pregnant glory of light, and the discords which the mind creates between truth and good and beauty, power and love and knowledge, will disappear on the eternal summit in the infinite extensions where they are always one. The Purusha in mind, life, and body is divided from nature and in conflict with her. He labors to control and coerce what he can embody of her by his masculine force, and is yet subject to her afflicting dualities, and in fact her plaything from top to bottom, beginning to end. In the Gnosis, he is Bayun with her, finds as master of his own nature their reconciliation and harmony by their essential oneness, even while he accepts an infinite blissful subjection, the condition of his mastery and his liberties, to the Supreme in his sovereign divine nature. In the tops of the Gnosis and in the Ananda, he is one with the Prakriti, and no longer solely Bayun with her. There is no longer the baffling play of nature with the soul in the ignorance. All is the conscious play of the soul with itself, and all itselves, and the Supreme and the Divine Shakti in its own and the infinite bliss nature. This is the supreme mystery, the highest secret, simple to its own experience, however difficult and complex to our mental conceptions, and the effort of our limited intelligence to understand what is beyond it. In the free infinity of the self-delight of Satchidananda, there is a play of the divine child, a rasa lila of the infinite lover, and its mystic soul symbols repeat themselves in characters of beauty and movements and harmonies of delight in a timeless forever. End of chapter 24, page 510.